Welcome, welcome, one and all. Welcome into the Scani Johnny podcast. I am your not so humble host, Jonathan Barnett, and with me, as per usual, is Aaron Flottam.
Hey, John, what's up?
So many wonderful things are up today. We have a wonderful start off with somebody from Cheesehead TV. It's Andy Herman. You can follow him at Scani Sports. So he's welcome and wonderful. Yeah. Big time news here today. So we'll start him off in the main event as we get going here. But remember, of course, you can follow me at JBarn54. You can follow the show at ScaniJohnny1, the number one. And Aaron, where do people follow you?
At Cheddar Talk, John.
Perfect. Saving time. You're always economical,
let's always. Let's get to Andy.
Perfect. So we're going to get here with a good Packers section here, off-season Packers talk with Andy Herman, starting off here with our main event.
Starting things off with the main event.
And so joining us, starting off our regular Packers coverage here, we're very fortunate, we're very lucky, as I said, to have Andy Herman here. You find him at Scani Sports. He does the Pack-A-Day podcast. He also does some writing with Cheesehead TV. Works with several of the other names there, big names we all know well here, and does the Green Bay Nation host on WFRV, correct?
Yeah, I'm on Green Bay Nation. I'm not the host. Lily Zhao is the amazing one that does that, but I get to be a part of that, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, and we're very glad to have you with us here. This is a big thing for us. We're very happy to have somebody who can give us like real numbers and real grades and such to kind of back up things we just think we see.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it. I'm excited to be talking to you guys. And like I said, I'm always happy to talk Packers, so this is great.
Wait, Andy does fact-based stuff? We're not going to have just all opinion-based tonight?
I'm going all hot takes.
Oh, okay. All night. All right, all hot takes. Good. All right.
Perfect. Now you'll fit right in with us. The first thing that I wanted to go over, and we talked about just before we started recording here, is you did have, it came out in January, but you did retweet it just recently, your end of the year best and worst. You graded everybody. You graded the entire team, correct?
Yeah, so it's a tiresome process. I grade every single player on every single play throughout the year. Basically, if you look at it this way, every play I watch, you know, basically at minimum 11 times to grade each individual player. Sometimes it takes a lot more than that. It takes me a full week every week just to grade one single game. And then obviously at the end of the year, I'm able to put the, you know, total grades together and kind of see who ended up, you know, doing really well, who ended up not doing so well. Most of the names are I don't think are going to be a huge shock, but, you know, of course, there's always some that kind of catch people off guard. So it's a process I absolutely love doing and kind of sets me up through the rest of the year to be able to talk about it and kind of review my notes and kind of go back and again, discuss it with people like you guys, which is great.
Yeah. We noticed that it's a great article. Everybody should go read it. It's fantastic. And it goes through and it's grading everybody. And it not only does the individual players, but individual best games and best ratings per snap throughout the season, which it's phenomenal. And you should all read it. And you are right in line with all of us here. Byron Bell gets the very worst rated player on the team, and Justin McCray right behind him. That right guard spot just killed us this year. It was horrible.
Yeah, it was brutal. In fact, I think I said, I don't know if it was in the end of the year article, but I said it at some point. I legitimately believe if they just had an average right guard, that it would have been worth two games in the standings. Not that that would have done much. They still would have probably missed the playoffs and everything like that. But that's legitimately how awful that right guard position was that, again, I think that it would have improved them by two games just by having an average guy. So it's going to be a huge opportunity in the offseason to try to upgrade that position. Bell was brutal. I'm not sure. You know, I've for the most part liked what Brian Gutekunst has done with the team since he's been here, but I am not sure what they saw on tape. Going back and reviewing the tape from previous seasons, it was very similar to what we saw in Green Bay this year. I can get behind wanting to bring a veteran into camp, but signing him for anything above the veteran minimum always seemed a little bit odd to me. And he, when given the opportunity, did not step up to the plate and prove that deal worthy in any way, shape, or form. So that was always a little bit of an odd one to me, and it certainly ended up that way.
Yeah, the number of times I've watched just even tweets or things you've put out with the video, and you just watch the entire line hold, and then just one guy pushed back 5 yards into the quarterback. That was definitely something to watch all year. You had actually, of your top five, you have four offensive linemen. That's just your offensive rankings. So you got Bell and McCray. You have Jason Spriggs, fourth, and Lucas Patrick, fifth. So that's a lot of depth we don't have right now.
Yeah, it's a position of struggle all throughout. You know, they've got Bakhtiari at left tackle, really strong. Lindsley, really strong. I actually like Lane Taylor a little bit more than maybe the average fan, but he really had kind of his ebbs and flows throughout the season. You know, he started to, or he really struggled, and then he kind of played okay, and then and he was just very, very up and down. So it's not like he is the solution to the Packers' problems. I think they can get by with him if he's the fifth lineman, you know, when he was expected to be the fourth, or a lot of games with Bulaga when Bulaga was out, when he was the third. You know, again, you're not going to perform at a high level when that's the case. But if he's your fifth, I think you're in an okay spot. I like Bulaga a little bit more than a lot of people do. I know he gets the injury struggles and you know, being able to consistently stay on the field has been a struggle, but he played almost 80% of the snaps this past year, so it's a little bit overblown. And when he was on the field, he played pretty well. In fact, the last couple games of the season, he was one of my highest graded players through those last couple games. So, the depth is the issue. Right guard is an issue, and they could certainly use some upgrades all across the line when it comes to depth, that's for sure.
Yeah, we can have this guy on the podcast whenever we want, John, because he just basically backed up a whole bunch of my factless based opinions with actual facts. Because I think we talked about that about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago with Lane Taylor too. It's like, he's not the problem. It's just that Lane Taylor is Lane Taylor. He's not going to be your number one lineman. And yeah, you got Bakhtiari and Lindsley who are studs. Great. Absolutely. And Lane Taylor, as long as he's, yeah, the number four or five guy on your line, then you're in a good spot, you know. So
did the Bulaga snap count stuff a couple weeks ago, talking about that, and I mean everybody missed a couple snaps, but yeah, he was in there in the 70s somewhere, and he did all right. I don't have an issue with his health problems as much as anybody else does, and for the money especially, I don't get the issues with him.
Any good, even average right tackle in the NFL right now is a really, really valuable player to have, because players coming out of college just aren't as developed, and it takes them a couple years to get to the level that they need to be at. Every single team is struggling to find good offensive line play, and especially at tackle. So even if you've got a guy who's playing almost 80% of your snaps at an average level, that guy is incredibly valuable. So to have him around, I think it's $8 million for this upcoming season, I will take that every single day of the week, because what, you know, especially right now, your alternative is Jason Spriggs, or, you know, I don't know what else after that. So yeah. There's not a great alternative on the roster. So to try to jettison him so quickly, which it seems like some fans want to do, is very, very odd to me.
No. And even like I told John last week on this podcast, that at $8 million for like a veteran super utility player that can play basically every position on the line, I don't know if he can snap the ball. But I mean, just for the $8 million alone for Bulaga, that's like it's
five,
stupid,
right?
To get rid of. Stupid.
It's just $5 million too, I think, right?
Sure.
Anyhow, didn't
Ryan Bulaga?
Yeah, Bulaga's just five this next year, correct?
Only one way to find out.
Google.
Right.
He is at.
This part of the podcast is brought to you by Google.
8.26 million this year. So yeah, he's in that $8 million range.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking next year. I thought he was only five, though.
His base salary is 5.8, but he's got some bonuses and stuff in there. Perfect. So he's at 8.26, and then next year in 2020, he's an undrafted or an unrestricted free agent. Excuse me.
Okay. So the one other thing, though, you do have Lucas Patrick here fifth. I want to know, there was the one play I want to know more than anything what he was rated at, and there's no way you have it handy. His kickoff return.
Well, unfortunately, the one thing I don't grade is special teams. So I focus solely on offense and defense. But, you know, I'd be hard pressed not to give him a perfect grade for that epic kicker turn. That's
except he got injured on
Andy,
the play.
I wouldn't have written about special teams in Green Bay in the last 10 years either, Andy.
Well, it's really easy. You just have to give it an F, and yes, nobody's going to question you anyway. So,
yeah.
L.
Well, I was at that game, actually, and it was hilarious because I'm sitting in that end zone, actually, that they were kicking to, and all of a sudden I turn to my dad and I just look out there. I was like, Dad, is that Lucas Patrick up there? Is the up back to lead block? And I was like, you're kicking at him, right? And then, of course, they did.
Ben Fennell did a great job early in the season of pointing out that they were the only team in the NFL who had an offensive lineman still in that position last year. So they were not, fast adopters with the rest of the NFL and putting more athletic players in that spot. And for some reason, really trusted Lucas Patrick in that spot. And certainly was nothing that ever really paid off.
No, and he didn't do it again for the rest of that game either because he got hurt on that play. Of the players on defense that you rated, it's very clear the hard spots on the Packers' defense. You have Matthews, Perry, and Reggie Gilbert as the three worst-rated defensive players, followed by Bryce and the departed Ha-Ha Clinton Dix. So it's outside linebacker and safety. Yeah.
Two positions of massive need, and again, that's not going to come as a surprise to absolutely anybody. And it's really a huge reason why I'm not on the re-sign Clay Matthews train, even at a veteran, at a lower cost deal. Why I've been kind of pining for the Packers to release Nick Perry, even though they're going to have that strong cap hit. I just don't see them as players that are helping the Packers win at this point. And to me, they're actually more of an issue than they are of helping the team at this point. So I think the Green Bay needs a huge influx of talent at that edge rusher position. And, I had a solid grade on Kyler Fackrell. We kind of touched base offline about how he was my fourth rated defensive player this year, but it's not because the defense was or because Kyler Fackrell was that great. It was kind of because the defense wasn't so great, and he's an ideal number three guy at edge. And if he's your second guy and you've got a really strong defense and you've got a really strong edge rusher opposite of him, could he be that number two? Sure. But ideally, he's your number three coming in playing 40-ish snaps a game. And we saw what he can do in that role this year as a 10-sack-a-year guy and put some consistent pressure on the quarterback. So I liked what I saw from him, but ideally, he's your number three.
Now, you also have Tremont Williams as your fifth-rated defensive player. Again, just a 1.25 positive rating on that. Now, I take it then, basically based off his two positions he played during the course of the year?
Yeah, that was both of them combined. And you really, taking a look at Tremont Williams, even at that grade, that's basically like a neutral grade. Anything about plus 1.5, negative 1.5 is really basically neutral. When you look at this defense as a whole, there were three players who were, kind of above average, and that was Mike Daniels, Kenny Clark, and Jaire Alexander. Fackrell was kind of next on that list, but the next grouping, including Tremont Williams, there was basically a neutral grade. And while I think Tremont Williams is a player that a lot of people, kind of had maybe some negative feelings towards, of course he struggled as a punt returner, certainly was not a game changer at either corner or safety, but he was exactly, in my opinion, what Green Bay expected him to be. He was not brought in to be a number one or a number two corner. He was brought in to be a stopgap, a guy who could still compete, wasn't going to lose you games, probably wasn't going to win you games. But I thought he played, again, at about a net neutral, maybe a small positive level. And I think that's what they expected from him. They weren't ever really expecting much more than that at his age and with the deal that they gave him.
Is he going to be able to play as long as Darryl Green did, well into his 50s?
I hope so. No, I mean, I think, Tremont's winding down here. He's probably got maybe 1 or 2 years left. Darryl Green had that ridiculous, 4.2840 coming into the league?
Yeah, it helps.
Well, who's that senior citizen that the Vikings keep bringing out every year?
At Antoine Winfield?
Yeah. No, not that one.
Yeah, he hasn't played in a couple of years. I don't know who else.
No, you're right. Who the heck is it? It's
He's been following what's his name around the coach around the league forever. Anyways, this isn't a Vikings podcast. They're all dead to me. And speaking of Clay Matthews, I'm going to put a 50% chance on him wearing a Vikings uniform next year because seems to be the natural progression of defensive players from the Packers as they go over to Minnesota and play for them.
Yeah, that would certainly seem within the realm of possibility.
The other big thing, I guess, that we want to talk about is you had something that you posted on Twitter today about Oren Burks. I think it was today or yesterday, either way. But Oren Burks and some of his plays, I think you're showing something even maybe Ben Fennell put up of how he's getting off blocks and the things he can do athletically. And just him being one of those big players that needs to have one of those big second-year jumps. I guess you want to discuss that and other players that you wanted to talk about as players needing to get that big second-year bump.
Yeah, so Oren Burks is a player that, I'll be totally transparent, I wasn't a huge fan of coming out of college. I thought he was going to take some time. The athletic traits are there. He's fast. He can be physical. It was always going to take some time his rookie season to kind of transition. Of course, out of college, he played some edge. He played some safety. He played some inside linebacker. It did seem like in his final season, he kind of found a home at that inside linebacker position. Of course, he kind of was having a stronger start to camp and then had some injury issues that kind of set him back. By the time he kind of got back into a little bit of rotation, they started to play him a little bit against New England, and New England attacked him immediately. I was never impressed with him in season this year in coverage, and he's got a ways to go before he can consistently take on blocks and consistently get to the running back and make the tackles that he needs to. But there are flashes that are absolutely there, and he has the athletic profile to be a very good linebacker in this league. And again, in preseason, both and in season, there were those flashes there that you saw from time to time. The play that I posted, he basically, the center comes out to attack him in the second level. He basically sheds the center immediately. The right guard comes out to get him. He sheds the right guard and then goes and aggressively makes the tackle on the running back. So it's plays like that, even from a Blake Martinez that you don't see enough of, where they can consistently get off of blocks and go make a tackle. He got off of two on one play and really made a nice play. So those plays are there. And again, you weren't really expecting much from him in his rookie season. If he can come in year two and show that development, put on some functional strength and really show that what he kind of learned from year one, that would be a huge get for the Packers to see him improve in year two to the level that he's capable of.
Yeah, I especially liked when he came out, the one thing that made me kind of hopeful, I love his athleticism, but I like that he did edge rushing as well. It showed me some that he could get off blocks a little bit. I need to see him be that physical player and get off those blocks, because he is a bit undersized with some of the running games that come up now. But yeah, it would be great to see him be able to get out there and actually be a blitzing type linebacker and make a lot of those plays behind the line of scrimmage, which we've been lacking. I'll grant you, though, that Blake Martinez did much better at that this year than he had in previous years.
Absolutely. And yeah, by the way, this was going to bug me forever, so I'm glad I finally thought of it. It was Terrence Newman, not Antoine Winfield.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, that's right.
I finally thought of it, and it makes me feel much better now.
Yeah, I get that. So we know that Jaire Alexander is obviously going to be the key to the development of this defense in terms of his jump. Is there any other player that stands out to you as somebody who you really are looking to see make that second year jump to being somebody more formidable in this offense or defense?
The receivers come to mind, both Equanimeous St. Brown and Marquez Valdes-Scantling, and you could see from both of them that they were thinking out on the field. So, while they showed those flash plays, Marquez Valdes-Scantling had a couple huge long touchdowns, and honestly should have had more had both Rodgers, and I think there was one from Kaiser too, but certainly Rodgers not missed him on a couple plays. Equanimeous St. Brown really showed out against the 49ers, showed in preseason that he had the agility to make quick moves on the second level. Both of those guys, if you put a highlight tape together for 2017, you come away incredibly impressed. When you watch them on a play-by-play basis, you can see just how much that they were kind of thinking through the process, trying to get to the right spot on the field and make a move, try to make somebody miss. And they were in no way, shape, or form at their peak performance or even close to showing what they're capable of if they really can kind of get the offense down. Now, what could potentially set them back, of course, is not now they have to learn an entirely new offense. And I had interviewed Tyler Meritz, the former Wisconsin Badger and the current Tennessee Titan, on the Pack-A-Day podcast. And he had mentioned that one of the tougher aspects of the offense was really the receiver position. And a lot of the unique things that they do to try to scheme their receivers open does put a lot of pressure on the receivers to really learn the playbook, dive in deep and really have a full understanding of it before they can go out and play at a high level. So they're going to have to now come in, learn a different offense, which even has some additional complexity to it. So those are two players that if they can get to the level that they could potentially get to, could completely open up this offense and really bring it to another level, especially in this Matt LaFleur-led offense. So I'm excited about both of them. I'm curious to see how they respond. I think Jaymon Moore is really going to struggle with this new playbook and learning a brand new one in year two with more complexity, but those two specifically I'm really excited to keep an eye on.
Excellent. And you mentioned your Pack-A-Day podcast, the one from today, which again, behind the curtain, everybody, we record Monday night still, as you all know. Your one today was great. It had Kelly Price as a guest that you brought on, and you guys talked about Florida players, And of course, different Packers that might be on their way out. You mentioned Cobb and Clay among the two big ones that seem to be obviously the most likely to be talked about.
Yeah, Kelly was phenomenal. I really appreciate her coming on. She does phenomenal work. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask her, obviously, as a reporter, she has access to interview the players. And I kind of wanted to get her feel and her take on, you know, as she was kind of interviewing players throughout the season and in the locker room, was there anyone that she kind of got the feeling that maybe it would be their last year? And she really got that feeling a little bit from Randall Cobb, that he kind of maybe could see the writing on the wall a little bit, and that it was maybe his last year as a Packer. So we kind of discussed that a little bit. Of course, she went to the University of Florida, so she's a big University of Florida Gators fan. We talked some Ja'Kai Polite and just kind of some of the Florida prospects, and it was just a great conversation to her. She brought her A game, and it was really a fun podcast to be a part of.
All right.
So well, what do you think about Cobb?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think I was on the Jordy Nelson train last year, that it was time to move on from him a season ago. In fact, my first ever radio spot that I got to do, they put me in the enviable position of talking about how maybe it was time to move on from Jordy Nelson. I thought I would be kind of banned forever from there on. But I was on that bandwagon a year ago, and I felt like that was the right decision to make. And I think if you compare apples to apples from where Jordy was at a season ago, to what Cobb is at now, I think Cobb is even more in that boat of it's time to move on. His numbers this past year compared to Jordy the previous year, again, I would take Jordy over that. So I think you can kind of read the tea leaves a little bit from what they did with Jordy a season ago, and they had to release Jordy, remember? So yes. It wasn't even just moving on from him where he was out of contract. They flat released him, and he was, think of it from Brian Gutekunst's standpoint. That was really his first move as right. general manager, you know, so to come in, be the new general manager, new guy on the block, to release Jordy Nelson, that is not an easy decision to make. So if that was his first decision, I got to believe that, you know, moving on from Randall Cobb may be in the same vein this year. And I do believe, you know, kind of some of the writing was on the wall, that picture with Aaron Rodgers and Randall Cobb together, kind of playing in that, you know, their last game together, that kind of spoke, you know, very clearly. The fact that his agent came out and said, and they haven't had any contract discussions with the Packers yet. I do think that it's probably time for them to move on. I think they will, but he's an interesting player. You know, he doesn't always get the credit that he deserves. You look at his yards per attempt, and it's a little bit skewed because he's taking a lot of those little basically extended handoffs, and he's not always put in a great position to succeed in those plays. So he's taking a lot of, you know, plays where he's getting it basically at -1 yard, and he's right. taking it 3 or 4 yards, and he's getting a 3 or 4 yard gain. And on the stat sheet, it looks like 1 catch for 4 yards or 1 catch for 3 yards. And it doesn't look really great, but he's working for those 3 or 4 yards, similar to what a running back would be. So I think there's some value there. It wouldn't shock me if he's back, but I do think that there's a very good chance that he's not.
Do you think someone will actually pay him the money that they're talking about, like more than single digit money per year?
Well, John Gruden's in charge of an NFL franchise.
Oh, there's that. Yes, good point. Great point.
You never quite know. And, you know, the famous saying, of course, is it only takes one team to be interested. He's got that pedigree. He's got the name. He's been a big-time Packer for a long time now. So it only takes one team to fall in love with him and see some of those traits that he brings. You know, we talk about players being a young 31 or, you know, he's an old 28, I want to say.
Right.
You know, he came into the league when he was, you know, I think 21, and was very, very young coming in. So he's got a lot of wear and tear on him for being as young as he is. But, you know, some team might see 28-year-old Randall Cobb, who's, you know, maybe still has some gas in the tank. And if so, maybe he does get six-ish million. I'd be fairly surprised, but you just never know in this league.
Roger.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have you, Andy. It's great to get anybody else to help us out here and to get a fresh look at things and to bring in so much expertise on the subject. So, again, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to let Andy go because he has quite a lot of actual work to do.
No worries. I appreciate you guys having me. This was a lot of fun. I would love to be back anytime. So I appreciate it, and you guys have a great rest of your night.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
Take care.
You bet.
And again, a wonderful thank you to Andy Herman for joining us today. We're going to move on now. We do have some Brewers news.
That guy is dreamy, John. Can we get him back sometime?
Right. Definitely. We're going to hold him to it.
He's got me hot and bothered with all those Packer facts.
Yeah. He said he'd join us again, so we'll keep him. We'll definitely hold him to it. But the Brewers this week did sign Mike Moustakas officially. It appears to be a one-year deal worth $9 million. Craig Counsell immediately said that he will be looking to have him get starts and get playing time at second base, at least when we start off in the spring training here. Your thoughts, Aaron, anything on that?
I am all good with it. Hey, I think everybody was, you know, with the backlog of Bryce Harper and, the guy with the bad hair.
Machado.
Looks like the roof.
Machado.
You know, kind of held up everything. I think we all kind of knew in our hearts that Moustakas would be back. And I like having him for the full season now, too. He's part of the club. You know, he finished the season. He's part of the... He's not going to miss a beat. And now this whole thing about moving him to second base, me and you were talking before the show started that, you know, you weren't going to move Mike Moustakas to second base at the end of last year after the trade. You're bringing him in as a ringer to finish off the season, put him at third. You take somebody like Travis Shaw. You move him because he's more comfortable with the all-around. Moustakas has enough other things with the transition coming in. You just want him to play ball, and you want him to feel good. Well, this guy's coming in now with spring training. Moustakas actually probably makes more sense in this rover kind of second base overshift position that Council's got going on. And my initial thought was right off the bat that if Manfred puts the DH rule into effect before the season starts, then Moustakas is your DH now. But I highly doubt
never
that's going to
that
happen.
Before the season starts. I've read that
a couple places. DH is in the National League is not going to happen this year. It'll be next year at best. But either way, happy to have Moustakas back. It makes the lineup formidable, and it gets rid of a hole. And now the lineup really doesn't have a hole in it.
Yeah, and it's nice. And he's a good guy to have in the locker room, and definitely everybody responded well to him. And it was great to see Yelich putting out the video of a guy in a moose suit doing a little dance. Clearly, the guys love having him back, so it's good. The
Absolutely.
News in terms of basketball for the state of Wisconsin, starting off with those who are professionals at basketball, the Bucks had one game. The Bucks played the Pacers. They beat them 106-97. They are now 5.5 up on the division. And yeah, their next game will be February 21st against the Celtics. In between, there was also an All-Star game. So the big thing is they're now 43-14 and first in the East. Toronto is a game back, but they've actually played two more. So they're 43-16. The Pacers in this game were up 79-76 at the start of the fourth quarter and were up 86-76 with 9:37 left in the game. The Bucks ended on a 30-11 run. That was pretty impressive, Aaron.
Well, it is impressive, too, and the fact that, you know, after the game that night, Coach Bude and Giannis and Chris Middleton were getting on a plane to go to Charlotte for the All-Star game activities. They're number one in the East. They've really got nothing left to prove at this point. They could have just mailed it in, right? They could have.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they didn't. And as a matter of fact, they hammered down hard to the point that I forget the player's name from the Pacers was out there playing hack-a-shack. Because he was getting so frustrated with the Bucks just being relentless down the stretch, and you know what, it says something to the coach, the superstar, and the secondary players on this team. They're for real, because you wouldn't have even faulted the Bucks for going into the whatever. It was just a throwaway game. No. They went down. Indiana's a formidable team in the East. With Oladipo gone, that could be argued maybe not so much. But either way, so they got that. And now coming out of the break, they're going to go up against Boston, the most underachieving team in the East that everyone still is convinced is going to win everything. I think this bodes well. What really impresses me more than anything else is that if you go on to any of your favorite sports websites, like, I don't know, ESPN, and you look at the shot chart and where the Bucks make all their shots, there's just a streak of made circles right underneath the hoop. I wonder who made all those shots.
Yeah,
but
Giannis ended with a triple-double in the game. He was 33, 19, and 11. Middleton put in 15. And like you said, the bench had a great job in this one. Ilyasova put in 11. He had 11, 5, and 5 to end the game. And George Hill put up 12 more points to help this team from the bench. So, yeah, all-around effort here. And this team definitely is in it to win. The Pacers are third in the East. They're the third best team right now in terms of record. Here's the thing that's fun. They are now, the Bucks, that is, they are now 16.5 ahead of eighth place, which is a tie between Detroit and Miami. And there are only 25 games left to play. They're only games away from clinching a playoff spot, basically.
Right, and because everybody forgets the All-Star break in basketball is not the halfway point. It's 2/3 of the way into the season. So, I mean, it's there. The playoffs are around the corner. And we haven't even seen Mirotić yet.
No, we have not. We haven't got a chance there, but it sounded like he has some injuries. I mean, so let him get healthy. It's I want to see him, and I want to see this team look great to end this year. They don't need to prove anything anymore in season.
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's what I'm saying is that so when it's been disclosed now that the Bucks knew that he had a little bit of a calf ankle something problem coming out of New Orleans, nothing serious, but it's nice to know that the Bucks aren't horribly dependent. They're not like, hey, we need Mirotić to make the playoffs. No, they're number one. So slowly add him in, and I'm as a Bucks fan my whole life who just stopped watching after a while, not that I didn't like the team, but just because there's nothing to watch. I'm this is unbelievable. I can't yeah. I don't know. It's good news all around. You know, which means they'll probably get bounced in the first round just to stick it in my face. But, you know, either way, it's nice having a good team.
Yeah, that was very articulate, Aaron. I appreciate you.
What part about getting bounced in the first round?
No, just it was so great. And
I'm the one that has the degree I can't even think right now.
Yeah, yeah. Also, Giannis and Middleton.
I have a degree in broadcasting. Come on. Right.
Giannis and Middleton both also looked very good in the All-Star game. Of course, Kevin Durant walked away, stole the MVP away from Giannis. That was clearly his to have.
He should have gotten the MVP just for the dunk.
Yeah, and I think the pass is actually more impressive than the dunk, but the whole play was great. If you don't know what we were talking about, then you don't have a Twitter account, and you aren't a Bucks fan in any meaningful way. So
I just love the fact that bounce pass got off the top of the screen. It was so high.
Yeah.
And you know what? Yeah, Steph Curry, absolutely. Without Steph Curry, he's the one that made that play happen. But with a bounce pass that high, I'm sure Giannis has never had to react to something like that in his entire life. The fact that he actually didn't choke and actually got the slam dunk done is quite impressive.
Moving on to the college ranks for basketball, Badgers men's basketball, tough week this week. They had a tough road loss in Michigan. They played two Michigan schools in the Big Ten. Lost to Michigan. It was a 61-52 loss, but it was basically the mirror image of the Badgers game in Camp Randall, at the Kohl Center.
Camp Randall.
That would have been a great game, a very cold game. In this one, with 4:17 left, Hap made a layup, and the Badgers were just down 50-51. From that point on, Michigan went on an 11-2 streak to end the game, kind of the opposite of what the Badgers did back in the Kohl Center when they played here. The game was actually tied 27-27 at halftime. They just could not finish out. They got a total of 4 points from the bench in this game, all of them from Kobe King. King went 4-4-1. The entire bench, 4 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists. The entire bench. Hap finished 18-11-1 with 2 blocks, but also had 5 turnovers, which equaled the total number of turnovers by the Michigan Wolverines in this game. I mean, the rest of the team had like 2 more, so it was pretty even, but Hap had 5 turnovers by himself.
Bold strategy.
Yeah, Reavers went for 9 points and 6 rebounds, also added 3 blocks to that. Wolverines were led by Charles Matthews, who had 18 points, 2 rebounds, 2 assists, and John Teske, 17-12-1. The team in this game was 0 of 2 from free throws. 0 of 2 for the game, the entire team. They don't know how to drive. And this is a big point I'll get to in a little bit here. But Michigan actually did not shoot particularly well. They were 44.6% for the game, 4 of 17 from 3. Badgers defense continued to play. They just did not get points when they needed points. They did not find their way to the free throw line. And that hurt them again later on against Michigan State at home at the Kohl Center, a 67-59 loss. They were down 56-55 with 6:04 left. And right after Hap made a basket. From there on, Michigan State won on an 11-4 run to finish out the game. The Badgers had 2 consecutive games against big-time opponents in which they had a game, they could have stayed in the game, and they just could not finish out the fourth quarter.
This team is just missing something. I don't know what it is, John.
The biggest thing that hurts, and Matt LaPay said it after the game, if you listened on the radio, Matt LaPay said this, they don't have dribble-drive guards. Their guards are three-point shooters. It's like they have several shooting guards. They don't have a point guard who can do the things that people like Devin Harris or those sorts of players did, where they could drive the lane and make you have to take them and make you have to foul them or make them dish pass.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was trying to get around to saying is that there's nothing electric about this team at all. It's pretty vanilla, I would have to say. I don't know, John. Maybe
they're a team that shoots and they like to shoot. And this was one where I don't know if everybody knows, but Trice is from the Michigan State area. He's from East Lansing area. So going back there and playing against that team, I guess he played this one at home. It's one he really wants to win. I believe his brother played for Michigan State. And this is the game he definitely wanted. But yeah, they just could not shoot their way out of this and they cannot get to the line. A game where, as a Wisconsin Badgers team, you're watching your team only get to the free throw line, only get to the free throw line twice is ridiculous. You can't play like that. You can't have your best players doing those things where you can't get in there and get those free points and put the other team in foul trouble.
Well, the problem is, too, is that if the Badgers actually get to the line, are they going to make the shots?
Yeah. Against Michigan State, too, the team did not shoot well. Davison had 9 points, but he did that on 3 of 12 shooting. He was 2 of 3 from the three-point line. As a team, they shot 42.9%. But yeah, some of their big players did not put up big games, did not have good shooting nights, and just couldn't get things done. They did bounce back with a win today as they finish out the year playing the Illinois schools and those sorts. So they beat Illinois today. Get the final score for you. It just went final here as we're recording. It's a little less impressive. They did struggle some coming into halftime. It was a very close game, and the Badgers managed to pull this one out.
Now, Twitter pretty much was confirming that the first half was hot garbage. So
yeah. A 64-58 win at home to the Illini. It looks like Brad Davison ended up with 18 points on 5 of 10 shooting, 6 of 8 from the free throw line. Pritzel led the team in rebounds with 10, and Davison had 3 assists to lead the team. Not an impressive win to be at home, the number 22 ranked team in the country, and beat Illinois by 6 points.
Right, it's Illinois. But then again, Illinois did beat Minnesota. Wait, what? That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, so the Badgers for the game, free field goal shooting 40%, three-pointers 27.8%. They did hold Illinois to 37.5% shooting. Again, the defense worked, but not enough people were scoring. Hap was held to 6 points, 3 rebounds, 2 assists in this game, and 1 foul. 3 of 7 shooting, no three-pointers. Reavers hit for 9 points. Davison, 18. Iverson, 16. And they did get 8 points from the bench for a 64-58 win for the Badgers. So they'll continue on down their little streak. I believe the next game will be against Northwestern. Hopefully that will get them something and they can finish out this well and get themselves a good seed in the Big Ten tournament so they can have some time to kind of recoup and get their jitters out. Stop having their bad shooting days. They can be done with that and start getting back into rhythm and get back into the tournament and be happy.
And also, too, I was thinking about this one. We should not count out, since we are a Wisconsin podcast about sports, Marquette is still number 11 in the nation. They finally fell out of the top 10, not because they did anything really wrong. They lost to St. John's 2 weeks ago, but that's about it. Since then, they beat Villanova, who was number 17 in the nation, or was number 15 at the time. And then they just beat DePaul the other night. But they play in the Big East, which is a dumpster fire nowadays. It's not what the Big East used to be. However, they're still number 2, and the new stadium is helping them out a ton. Marquette is 10-2 in the Big East right now, with a 21-4 overall, and 15-1 at home, and 5-2 away. Wait, how does that work?
I don't know. But the nice thing is that they did. I mean, they lost to St. John's on a close game. But then they did go beat Villanova and then destroyed DePaul. I mean, that's not the greatest thing, but I mean, 3 games left this month. They get to play Butler, they get to play Providence and Villanova again. And, you know, they're the 11th ranked Marquette Golden Eagles. And you're right. You're right. We definitely need to talk about them more. And I think about that every time I see them playing, and I see that they are clearly the best college basketball team in the state of Wisconsin at this point. And they did beat the Badgers this year, as we talked about. But yeah, no, they're going to be a good
because
team.
Because otherwise, in a couple weeks from now, we're going to be talking about the NIT only with the Badgers, whereas if we have Marquette to still talk about, then we can talk about the tournament.
No, the Badgers are going to make the tournament, and Marquette's going to make the tournament, and I think they're both top 16 programs, and I think they're going to do well. I think they're both going to make Sweet 16. That's my call at this point. I think when they got Wojo there, that they were going to be a team that built up to something quickly. They had the greatest moment from the win against Villanova was, if you watch the local broadcast, the national broadcasters decided to say that one of the players from Marquette played at Spash, a several-time state champion, Stevens Point Area Senior High, the Panthers, which is, one of their players is from Spash. So like, oh, he's from Stevens Point, which is, if you who aren't around here, is just outside Green Bay. And, of course, everyone in Wisconsin cringed because it's not at all outside Green Bay. It's an hour and a half away.
It's because everybody references everything from Green Bay
or Milwaukee.
People only know where Green Bay is because of Monday Night Football and Sunday Night Football. Because outside of that, Superior, Wisconsin, just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Well, when I travel places with the Army, they would always be ask me where from. Like, oh, Wisconsin. They're like, well, where about? I'm like, well, Stevens Point, right in the middle. I live right in central Wisconsin. They're like, oh, is that so near Milwaukee, right? I was like, no. I was like, Milwaukee's down in the corner. It's where we keep it. It's like, it's right down by Chicago. You know where Chicago is, right?
It's a Gaffigan bit. Where are you from? Chicago. Where in Chicago? Oh, just outside of Chicago. Oh, really? Where's that? Milwaukee.
Yeah. Well, it's also like I was on a Habitat for Humanity build in college, and Cornell University was there as well. So they had a group of college students there, and I was like, well, that's impressive. It was Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. And we started talking. They're like, where are you guys from? They're like, oh, Cornell. I'm like, yeah, it's like upstate New York, Ithaca. And they're like, yeah, Ithaca, yeah. And they're like, where are you guys from? I'm like, well, we're mostly from Wisconsin because we're UW-La Crosse. And they're like, oh, that's in Minnesota, right? I was like, nope, kicking it as our own state for quite a while now, 100 some odd years. I was like, because it's over 150 at that time, and it's over 160 now. So I was like, what? They thought Wisconsin was a city in Minnesota. This is an Ivy League school.
Well, French Island is only about half a mile away from Minnesota. So
yeah, but that's all that we have for the main event. And so now we'll start wrapping things forward with what we call the tale.
Rapid fire time now with the tale, covering Wisconsin's other sporting events.
Aaron, the first thing I want to cover just briefly, at least in the tale, is UW women's basketball. They are 12-14 overall, 3-11 in the Big Ten. They did just this last week beat number 24 Michigan State, 79-62 win. That was kicked off by a 22-8 first quarter. That win snapped Wisconsin's 32-game streak of losing against every ranked team they'd played. So congratulations to the women's basketball team, but it's not a good year. It's been a tough year. They then immediately lost 70-68 to Ohio State in an away game. They will be playing to end out this month a home game against Illinois, away at Rutgers, and then home to Ohio State again. They were led in the Michigan State game, 28 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists by Masha Howard, and Kelly Carlis got 13-10-1. Moving on to men's hockey. The Badgers split this weekend with previously 15th ranked, now 16th ranked Notre Dame. In Notre Dame, they won 2-1 on Friday. They outshot Notre Dame both games this weekend. Friday in the win, they outshot them 37-31. Got goals from Linus Weisbach and Roman Akhan. And then the next game, they immediately lost 5-2 on the Saturday game. In that loss, they got bookend goals. They scored the first and last goals of the game. Goals were by Matthew Freitag and my favorite name in hockey, Sean Doogie.
Yes. Thank you, Sean Doogie.
In this game, they did still outshoot the Notre Dame Fighting Irish 34-31. Again, for everyone who doesn't remember, Notre Dame is a Big Ten school for hockey.
Yes. They're actually affiliated with conferences in every sport except for
football. Yeah. Yep. That's because
NBC won't let them be in a conference.
And there's no money for them being in a conference to make enough without it. In terms of women's hockey, UW women back on top.
And they throw off everything when it comes to the playoffs, too, because...
We're moving on, Aaron. Women's hockey now, again, number one ranked women's hockey. They swept UMD. The Bulldogs of Duluth swept them 6-1 and then 3-0 on Saturday. In the 6-1 game, they got two goals from Emily Clark. They then got other goals from Presley Norby, Sophie Shirley, Sam Kogan, and of course, Annie Pankowski. They outshot UMD in this game 44-20. And they chased the goaltender Maddie Rooney in the second period. So she played the first two periods, and then they brought in the backup because it got so out of hand being a 6-1 game. On Saturday, they then came out and got a got a 3-0 win. Alexis Mauerman, Emily Clark, and Sam Kogan got the three goals. They outshot them in this game. They outshot the Bulldogs 52-24.
See, now this is crazy too, because back when I went to UW Spear in the late 90s, UMD was one of the first D1 schools to have women's hockey. And Shannon Miller was a coach who, of course, won numerous gold medals for the United States, at least two for women's hockey. UMD got all the talent. So small schools like UW-Superior, my freshman year at UW-Superior was ridiculous. Our women's team was winning games literally 20-1 because it was the first not intramural girls hockey team. So UMD getting outshot like that, that's what UMD used to do to people. In the early 2000s, people don't remember this, but their women's team was unstoppable. And friends of mine played for the Minnesota State Mankato Mavericks hockey team back then. And I think there's still a record. We'll have to go and look at it. We'll talk about it later. Either way, the goalie from Mankato took 76 shots in a game and saved. And she holds the record for most shots taken in a game and most saves in a game, because even though she gave up 6 goals, she still had 70 saves.
Yeah.
So either way, that's what UMD used to do to people. So it's kind of backwards now. And on Wisconsin. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I also remember when Bemidji State and what was formerly known as Mankato State were both teams in the NCHA playing D3 hockey. Speaking of D3 hockey, the men's team, St. Norbert, played in the NCHA tournament this weekend. They beat Finlandia in both games, 2-1 and then 9-0. They will move on to play Marion next. UW River Falls beat UW Stout in the play-in series for the WIAC playoffs. That means that they get the right to play undefeated number one ranked UW Stevens Point.
That means they're going to lose Stevens Point.
And now number 6th ranked UW Eau Claire Blue Golds will play the UW Superior Yellow Jackets. And remember that, of course, the Yellow Jackets just beat Superior the weekend ago. So
just beat Eau Claire a weekend ago.
You're right. Eau Claire. Yeah. Sorry if I misspoke.
Yeah. That's so, right. Yeah. They beat up on Eau Claire. So when Eau Claire had to play Stevens Point, they got mutilated by Stevens Point.
They got boat raced on that one. So yeah, that's our rundown of Wisconsin sports here. So we'll move on to the last little bit. Give us a chance to get things off our chest.
Time to look around and get your bearings, because it's time for the last call.
Aaron, this week, the one thing I want to talk about, and I want to start off briefly, is just going to be about Colin Kaepernick. And I don't.
Strong.
And it's no hot takes in this, really. And that's the one thing I want to say, is the hot takes are crazy. The hot takes on this all week long have been crazy. Here's what happened. There was a settlement with Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid and the NFL. It was a settlement. And both sides came out, people supporting both sides, the NFL or hating Kaepernick or liking Kaepernick, and I don't care either way. All right? The only thing that I want to say about this is it was a settlement. And these happen all the time. Almost every case settles. I worked out a settlement just this last week in a mediation that I did in my work. It doesn't mean that either side is admitting defeat. Because if one side's case was so terrible that they were admitting defeat like this, then you go to court with those people because they have nothing to lose. The NFL gave up money. And part of the thing that you do when you do negotiations like this is you take into account what the cost of litigation will be. And if you're willing to pay that off, plus a little bit more, then that's a good win. So the idea that somehow the NFL has admitted they were colluding by giving money is ridiculous and short-sighted and doesn't take into account the fact that this happens all the time. People just settle all the time. If they didn't, we would be in courthouses every day. There would always be a trial going on if people didn't settle. The key point of our justice system and our civil justice system is people settling. They will do everything they can to get you to settle in court. The other thing is, it doesn't mean that Kaepernick was all about the money. It was a settlement on a legal claim. The only thing the court can give him is money. It can't give him a job. It can't give him anything else. The court is very limited in what it can do in terms of giving you something to make up for something. So in return, the NFL gave him money, an amount they were okay with, but they didn't give him his job, and they didn't admit they were wrong, and Kaepernick didn't get to win on any merits. It doesn't mean either one of them was right or wrong, and you don't get to draw any specifically big, giant conclusions from it without being insane and self-righteous. It was a settlement, and that's the only thing you can really draw from it. Aaron, what do you have this week?
Well, I'm going to piggyback off that a little bit. I'm going to do my usual hodgepodge here at the end. So, and my take on the whole Kaepernick thing, too, is, and we talked about this last week, yeah, it might not have been all about the money. But at the same time, so my biggest take on the Kaepernick thing, and everyone's kind of missing out on this, and we've talked on this podcast about it, is that I don't think he could get a job if he had to. He was this bottom five quarterback in the league. He had just gotten benched for Blaine Gabbert, right? Blaine?
Gabbert.
Blake. Gabbert.
Blaine Gabbert.
Blaine Gabbert in San Francisco. And some people will say that he kneeled to keep his job. Sports Talk Barry. No, I, either way, one way or the other. That's hot garbage. But either way, so, but the thing is that at this point right now, I don't think Colin Kaepernick wants to have a job offer, because I don't think he wants to go out there and prove that he can still play. Because if he starts going out there and starts slinging the ball around and people actually see that he's not good anymore, that kind of defeats him, because that would say that he doesn't want it. He doesn't want a job offer. That's why when the AAF came to him, he wanted $20 million because he wants to make it impossible. He doesn't want to play, because at this point right now, if he goes out and looks like garbage when he's on the field, he's going to prove the NFL right. That's the only thing that he can do right now. The worst thing that Colin Kaepernick can do right now is get on a field and try and throw a football. Or try and play against, because he's been out of the league for 2 years. He's probably not practiced against any sort of real-time defense. He's going to look bad anyways. He looked bad before he left anyhow. So that's my thing about him. I want to thank Andy again for coming onto the show. It was a big-time guest we got in here. He did bring up something on his Twitter feed here about we're so lucky right now to have Giannis, Rodgers, and Yelich, two people who have been MVPs of their league, and Giannis, who should be but probably won't because everyone's so infatuated with Harden, and George. So he probably won't. He Paul probably George. Won't get the MVPs. The MVP for this year, one of those guys will. As a matter of fact, ESPN, I watched them do a whole thing about Russell Westbrook, Paul George, and Harden. Who's going to get it? And they didn't even mention Giannis once, which is a sin. So, but yeah, as my reply to Andy on Twitter, yeah, this is huge, because I remember back in the Anthony Dilwig, Jack Sikma, we were all over the board. Oh, my last thing. Oh, so for remember the old WCHA before it dissolved because of the Big Ten?
Yeah.
And well, my friends in Minnesota were talking about this week. Right now, the number 1, 3, and 4 teams in Division I hockey are St. Cloud State, Minnesota Duluth, and Minnesota State. Remember how everyone was going to say that the Big Ten was going to start running away with college hockey? Well, my old WCHA team's right there at the top. So that's the end of my rant. Thank you, John.
But that's just because they don't have to play the Badgers or the Gophers anymore. Just beat up on each other and carry on. Anyhow, yes, as Aaron said, thank you again to Andy Herman for joining us. Thank you for all of you for joining us this week. And hopefully everybody has a good week. And we have some more news to come back to you with next week. And, of course, always follow us at JBarn54, at Cheddar Talk, and at ScottyJohnny1. And if you want to email the show, do so at ScottyJohnny@gmail.com. And remember, whether you are on the town or on the go, it is always on Wisconsin.
Jump around.